Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for February 23rd. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and with me on another beautiful Saturday morning is Jim Allen. What's happening, buddy?
Well, it is a beautiful morning. I'm good. How about you?
Man, I can't believe the luck we're having when we sit down to tape. We should be outside. We should be at a ballpark somewhere taping.
Cool to be at a ballpark
in Tokyo.
At 9 a.m. in the morning in Tokyo. Yeah,
we should be in Okinawa. A ballpark.
Okay, I'll go with that.
On this week's show, we've got a chat with SoftBank Hawks conditioning coach Atsushi Torida, and we're going to talk about Hiroki Kuroda, Samurai Japan, and more. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
Okay, well, let's go. First of all, John gets to run the trivia gauntlet today.
I'm going to fall in the pit.
That's right. Yes, this is trivia. You speak of Spartacus.
Yes, and I just hope that it is not bottomless.
That's good luck with that.
Oh, great. Okay. You're just trying to get me back because I asked you something that you just had no interest in last time.
Well, yeah. Okay. Arches are different. Okay, that's all right. I liked it, actually.
Okay.
Okay. This is something I wouldn't have counted at all. Okay, now on August 17th, 2004...
I was not here. This is not
fair. I know. This is a segue. You know, those things you stand on when you walk, you move, but you don't walk.
Okay.
Kimiyasu Kudo hit his only career home run off Jason Beverlin of the Yakult Swallows. Now, that put him into a club with four Hall of Famers, Osamu Higashio, Hisashi Yamada, Minoru Murayama, and Choji Muramoto. I don't expect you to know who any of those people are or to know their stats. Okay, good. Now, Kudo's homer now makes Masahiro Yamamoto unique in the history of Japanese baseball. Why? What makes Masahiro Yamamoto unique in the history of Japanese baseball?
Wait a minute. You throw out the 2004 date.
Mm-hmm.
So you get
the date's not relevant. It's
just
that
you're giving me all this information. You're stirring up the pot, and you're telling me, you can't smell what I'm cooking, but what am I cooking? I don't know.
Well, it has to do with the home run that Kudo hit and the fact that Kudo joined a very elite group.
It's not
a difficult question if I phrase it more easily. It's a very easy question because you know all the relevant you may know all the relevant facts.
All right, 2004.
That's not the date is not important, but Kudo hit his only career home run.
So maybe Yamamoto is a pitcher who has never homered.
That's correct, and
he's still active.
There's a whole bunch of them.
And.
No, unique in the history of Japanese baseball.
He's the oldest pitcher. He's the pitcher with the most at-bats to have never homered.
That's an interesting one. I doubt that's true, but that may be true.
All right, well, I give up.
Okay. Four Hall of Famers. Now five Hall of Famers. What do Hall of Fame pitchers often have in common?
They pitched well.
They did indeed. They did in more than pitch well. They got the numbers to show it. They get wins.
I'm so confused.
They've got wins. What's the magic number for wins in Japan?
Oh, these are guys who have 200 wins but no homers.
Well, those are guys with 200 wins and one home run.
So Yamamoto is a guy.
He's the only pitcher in Japanese history with 200 wins and no home runs.
Oh, only guy.
The only guy. I was shocked.
Wow.
I figured it's one of these Pacific League guys, but you see the Pacific League guys had one. I mean, Kudo went to the Central League and he had a home run.
Wow.
And of course, Kudo's, the date is interesting. Kudo hit his only home run in his career in the game in which he won his 200th victory.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's kind of.
I didn't know that either.
Well, you weren't here, so I didn't expect that. But that's actually part of that's sort of a hint. But the only point is, these four pitchers were the guys who hit one home run and won 200 games because they were all Pacific Leaguers.
Interesting. All right. I like it. I mean,
In retrospect, you like it.
Yeah, I don't know if I like the smell of it, the way you stirred it up. And
well, I didn't know.
You're leading the horse in different directions.
I didn't know how to make it that would make it too obvious.
I think you could have asked straight up and it wouldn't have been too obvious. I think it would have been all right. It
would have been impossible if I just asked it straight up.
Okay.
Okay. Now, our guest today, coming from Miyazaki City, Japan, the home spring training home of the SoftBank Hawks, is Atsushi Torida, and he is one of the two physical conditioning coaches of the SoftBank Hawks. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Torida caught my attention a few years ago. I read a story about him when I was with Yomiuri about this guy who had gotten his trainer's license in the U.S., and he spent 10 years in the Expos and Nationals organization. And so I talked to him whenever I see the Hawks up here, and I run into him. And so finally we got him on the show, and he talked about this and that. And so, you know, I asked him a few questions about how he became a trainer and so on and so forth, and some of the differences that he notices between tried to do more about physical conditioning and training. Now, he was a trainer in the States, and now he's a conditioning coach here in Japan. So his role is different, but he's sort of like Forrest Gump in the United States. He knows all the trainers, but his history, his career intersected with all these interesting people mm-hmm. in the States. And none of which you'll hear here, but he's a fascinating guy and very opinionated, and so he's a great listen. So let's hear what Mr. Torida has to say. Our guest this week is Mr. Atsushi Torida, and he is the conditioning how many conditioning coaches are there at the Hawks?
Two in the major Ichigan, the major league level, and the one each the minor league team. We have two minor league teams, so total four.
Okay, so one of the conditioning coaches for the Hawks first team in the Pacific League. Welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, you have a very interesting career. You started your career as a physical trainer in the United States, which is it's not unusual for Japanese to go abroad and do physical training and sports medicine. So what was your background or why were you why did you decide to go to the United States to try that?
The main reason was like when I was playing baseball, junior high school and college, then in the college sophomore year I hurt my shoulder.
Okay.
That was like first big injury I heard playing the baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Then my team in college, I mean, it's not like private school or anything, mm-hmm. so we didn't have any trainer or team doctor or anybody. I visited some doctors by myself, mm-hmm. but they really couldn't tell what was wrong. Oh. So I just learned what kind of injury baseball has, you know, baseball players have,
right.
and how they train, how they rehab those, going through some books, magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Then my interest of sports medicine, you know, getting bigger, growing. Then one magazine talking about a training license as a national license
right.
in the United States.
Oh.
So at that point, I didn't, you know, even think of I'm going to go to the U.S. to
right.
study about athletic training. Originally, I was thinking going, I mean, then I decided to want to be the trainer to take care of the baseball player, but originally I was thinking going some physical education school, college in Japan
right.
for graduate school.
Right.
But a lot of trainers that time working for industrial baseball league or some other college, they told me I should go to U.S.
Okay.
It was kind of trend that time, and there's not many education system for athletic training in Japan
right.
that time. That's why, I mean, it's more like natural to think about going U.S. to learn something like athletic training.
Mm.
So that's kind of the main reason.
Oh, okay. So it was kind of a long route you took because you started you started at Indiana, and it's a really good story, but it's a long story. But I and you finished up in New Hampshire, and then tell me about your first job you got as a sports trainer.
My first job was independent baseball league.
Okay.
Assistant trainer.
Okay.
It's like an internship.
Okay.
For the one season from May to September.
Okay.
I applied for this because this team was looking for the trainer on the website. I applied for that position. Then I knew it required to get the license to be, full-time trainer.
Right.
But I couldn't pass the exam the first time. So they hired me as an assistant trainer, as an intern.
Okay.
So me and the head trainer, they hired another guy as a head trainer. We worked together. Then this team was a brand new team in Rockford, Illinois.
Okay.
They just moved the team from Springfield. Then basically they didn't have anything. It's called modality, like a ultrasound unit or a stim unit, anything to treat the player's injury. So we, start looking for some place to who can lease those device for us or rent us something. But then, one of our team doctors, who is chiropractor, helping us to get those devices or some kind of like garbage sharing supplies.
Right.
But it was a great experience for me because we started from nothing, making order to make a system, how we're going to take care of their daily program.
Okay.
So that's still my bottom line and basic experience for the athletic trainer. Because of that experience, I can start my athletic training career.
Okay. Now you obviously you became a trainer in the U.S. and then you came to Japan, and was it a shock to see how the way the players prepared for the games or practiced for the games or the way the drills or what was the big striking difference for you?
I already knew, the players in Japan, they practice a lot.
Sure.
But it's because of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you can also, it says, like, schedule is different.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The spring training camp, they take extra fungal, extra batting practice a lot. Then I knew they're going to work out like that because they run more. Then I was always thinking, why they have to do this? Why they need to do this?
Yeah.
Then one thing I found out was system.
Right.
In the United States, in the minor league, each team has like 6 or 7 minor league teams under the major league team.
Sure.
They develop the players to move those at a level higher, or they struggle, they just send them down.
Right.
That's how they develop the players. They practice too. They do early work, extra hit, but not as much as here in Japan.
Sure.
Because their idea is they need to train the players in the game. The practice is just get ready for the game.
Right.
You can't really train the players from the practice. They need to be trained in the game, the real game.
That's
why they play more games and they move the players in different level.
Sure.
But in Japan, we can't do that.
Yeah.
Most of the team has only one minor league team and one major league team.
Right.
You, like, even the first year player, you might have a chance to play in the big league game in that year.
Mm.
Out of high school.
Sure.
If somebody get hurt, there's no, like, free agent sign
right
in Japan. Middle of the season.
Right.
So you might be the only player need to play in the position
right
in the major league, major league level
sure
during the season.
Right.
So if you think about it like that, even first year high school kid,
right,
if the coach is thinking, oh, this guy is not even close to playing the big league level,
right,
but if this he has a chance to play in the big league this year,
right,
oh, we need to train them a lot.
Right.
You need to practice a lot.
Right.
I think that's the kind of idea in Japan, how to train, how to develop the players because of the less team in the minor league.
Right, the depth is completely different. Now this year, you have a new manager with the Hawks, Kimiyasu Kudo, and he's basically a fitness conditioning, you know, he loves studying and learning about fitness and conditioning. What's the difference been? I know he's talked about to the media, he's talked to, and to the players about preventing injury, about not getting hurt. Mm-hmm. So how is that working out in camp?
It has been good. We didn't have any major injury, especially in the Ichigo, the major league level. Then what he tried to do is build up the new medical system.
Okay.
It's kind of, he said it's new, but to me, this is not really like anything special.
Okay.
But more like anything, it's supposed to be go that way. Like,
it's common sense to you.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's as a team.
So, okay, just to go back, so a lot of the things that you know, Kudo is talking about seems like a common sense. Is it, and you say it's not new, but is it different from the way things had been with the Hawks?
If you want to do it as a team,
right,
more people involved, every single one of those people, the person,
right,
need to really put in their mind all the time.
Oh, okay.
What he's trying to do is like sharing the information.
Okay.
Of each players
between
trainer, conditioning coach, manager, and each other coaches, pitching coach, hitting coach, battery coach, infield, base running coach, and any coaches need to involve that loop.
Okay.
So they need to share the information. What that means is if you feel something wrong with the players, it doesn't have to be the manager, but you need to share that information to other coaches or trainer or conditioning coaches.
Okay.
Then to find out what was really wrong with them. Then make a decision of what they need to do on that day, what they need to play a game or not, something like that.
Okay.
So he just want every single person in the team, especially coaches and trainer and conditioning coaches, they need to have a common information of each players.
Okay.
So I think this is, you know, I was working in the U.S. as a trainer. We do the same thing too.
Right.
Like, the best word to describe this, everybody on the same page.
Okay.
Everybody on the same page about each players.
Okay.
Then, you know, if somebody has different pages, like, hey, You guys saying about this player like this, but I feel different.
Okay.
I feel this is something, you know, we kind of like overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get more into it.
Right.
I mean, that's great too.
Yeah.
That's what he wants.
So I see.
First thing is everybody needs to be the same page.
Right.
Everybody needs to think about, they need to know about what other coaches think about these players.
Right.
And, I feel different.
Yeah.
I feel something, you know, I'm looking at some other part of this guy.
No.
Something like we need to share the information.
Right.
To bring the one decision.
Okay.
Now, that's what he tried to do.
Okay. Yeah. Now, last year you had a situation, you told me, where Hasegawa, Yuya Hasegawa, the outfielder, you know, he injured his ankle, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Ankle. Yeah.
Yeah. You told, and you know, and he's hurt, and they asked him, "Can you pinch hit?" He says, "Yes." tell me you were thinking about.
Yeah, this is like a Japanese culture thing. I think the players, if you ask, if no matter what kind of problem they have, if you ask players, "Hey, can you play?
Right.
Can you do this?" They're not gonna say no. Hasegawa probably, even if he broke the ankle,
right?
His answer was probably yes. So, yeah, I mean that's great, like mentality. I think.
Right, but
I like that. But in the real world, if you put the players who is not in good condition,
right,
then if there's other players in good condition,
right,
skill wise, the experience wise, mm-hmm. they might be, you know, less than this player get hurt,
right,
but if they are in good condition, you never know what's gonna happen.
Sure.
If your condition is not good, the possibility of the good outcome is going down.
Sure.
For sure. So Kudo-san just want to avoid the situation like that. I think.
Okay.
If this guy has a good number,
right,
but his condition is not good, then other guys on the bench, these guys, he doesn't have a good number, but his condition is pretty good. Then if hitting coach said, hey, the practice, this guy was swinging the bat really good. Now, which one you want to use?
Yeah.
That's the question. Then to make that decision, of right. course, he needs to get the information.
Sure.
So other thing is, if we, like Hasegawa's case, even if he said he can play,
mm-hmm.
somebody needs to stop.
Right.
Somebody needs to make a line.
Mm-hmm.
For him and
right.
for the team.
Right.
In Japan, we really, you know, don't have the role
mm-hmm.
of like making the line.
Right.
This player can do this much or this player cannot do this.
Yeah.
When I was in US, the mm-hmm. trainer was the one to make the role.
Right.
Then, you know, I was always, it's more like a suggesting.
Right.
Hey, this guy's feeling this today. How about, you know, practice, like, just, you know, not hitting the field before the game.
Right.
Then if you want to use him in the game, just get him rest mm-hmm. during the practice.
Sure. Then
we check him how he moved before game start or something like that.
Be pretty rare. It's pretty rare in Japan for teams to limit practice. You can keep
right.
the guy out. You can practice him, but not play him. But you can't play him and not practice him.
Right. You know, trainers suggest like that. It's pretty rare.
Yeah.
But somebody need to make a line at some point.
Mm.
You know, the case player might be fine if uh-huh. he practices before the game.
Right.
But you never know.
Mm-hmm.
He might, if he practices before the game, you see his symptom getting worse, he might not be able to play.
Right.
I feel like, if you have a chance to make his problem, injury or sickness or
right.
whatever, his problem getting worse, if there's a possibility, you shouldn't do that.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of simple.
Right.
But it's really tough to make where you need to make a line.
Sure. Now,
yeah.
you told me that, you know, well, I guess I mentioned before that Sadaharu Oh told me before that the players will tell you,
uh-huh.
like you said, you know, with Hasegawa, can you play? Yes. Are you fine? Yes. And players will say they can play and they're not hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But he told me that they'll often lie about it. You know, they'll say, yeah, I'm fine. And they can't walk, you know, whatever. They'll
uh-huh.
do anything they can to stay in the game.
Right. It's a lie.
Yeah,
I would say it's a good lie.
Yeah,
but as a team,
mm-hmm.
it's not really good.
Okay.
So I mean, you can say anything you want.
Right.
They can say anything you
sure.
want. Sure. But if you look at him,
mm-hmm.
look at them, how they move.
Right.
They cannot lie.
Right.
So I mean, you know, if you are worried about his swing,
mm-hmm.
you're worried about his running.
Right.
I mean, let them do it. Just check
mm-hmm.
how they move.
Right.
I mean, they can, if they run fine,
mm-hmm.
that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if they are not fine, then if they're saying, like, I'm fine,
yeah.
have them run.
Mm-hmm.
Look at how they move.
Right.
Then you can probably tell.
Do you have that? Have,
so,
you, have you done that with a player where, you know, he said he was fine and you thought no, and so, okay, show me your running?
Yes, all the time.
Oh. Oh, they must be very happy with you.
Well, that, you know, that's kind of my job.
Right.
To make sure.
Right.
Wrong. Then if that's the case, this is sharing information too.
Right.
You need to tell the manager.
Right.
Hey, this is what I think. This
right.
guy's saying this, but this is what I think.
Okay.
What good manager,
mm-hmm.
what he's gonna say, oh, let's look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at it. Bring him out to field.
Right.
We just test it before game start. That's what we were doing. I was doing in the U.S. Like, hey, this guy rolled the ankle yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
The sweating is not too much,
mm-hmm.
but it's gonna hurt.
Right.
So I think we should, you know, give him a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
If okay. the manager says, you know, all right, that's fine. Give him a day or two. We're not gonna use him.
Mm.
If player says, hey, I can run. I can run. I mean, you know, I don't have any problem running. It's not going to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
That's the case. We need to say, all right, let's do it. All right, before practice, I go outside. We run the bases.
Okay.
Then have him run. Hey, this is not even close. To me, it looks like not even 60%.
Okay.
And we can put you in a game like this.
Yeah.
Manager, if the manager looking at that too, I mean, he's going to feel the same thing.
Right.
This actually happened.
Oh, yeah.
When I was in the AA, uh-huh. Hattiesburg, player named Danny Espinosa.
Okay.
He's like really active, energetic, young kids. I mean, he's still young, but back then, even much more, you know, energetic. He pulled a hamstring or quad, I don't remember, 3 or 4 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Then he kept playing. Just mm-hmm. getting worse, but it was obvious. So I suggested, hey, Danny, well, we need to get time probably. I don't know, maybe a week or so. He denied my opinion.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm playing. I'm playing. No matter what happens, I'm playing. All right, let's check, you know, how can you can run before game start. I mean, before the practice. We have you run the bases. Show me you can run 100%. Then me, manager, Danny went outside to have him run the bases. I mean, you can tell
he, mm-hmm.
something wrong with him.
Now,
our manager was a pretty good guy.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, he really have good common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Danny, if you run like this, no matter how you can hit, I don't care. We're not going to use you. We're going to use another guy on the bench.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much. We've been talking a long time, much longer than this short part on the podcast, and I want to thank you very much for your time on your rare off day in spring training. And
We really don't have a real off day. We have a meeting with Kudo-san today too.
Okay. So you better do your homework for that. And thank you again for joining us on our podcast. I look forward to hearing you next time.
No problem. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks much. Well, thank you. Thank you for being on our show, and hopefully we will get you again, but we don't have to tape over that horrible connection.
Yeah, it's good hearing you. I'll probably meet you when I go out and cover the SoftBank Honks this year.
Yeah, I was wondering, I knew he played baseball, but I was wondering what position he played, because my first guess was catcher.
Uh-huh.
Because he has sort of a catcher's body.
Catcher's, you know, body. Maybe he's got a catcher's body now.
Okay, could be, yes. He's really strong. I mean, he's really powerfully built, as I guess one would expect of a physical trainer. So, okay, that was the first time to hear Mr. Torita. So what'd you pick out of that?
Well, first of all, you sent me enough material, basically in two files, to do about 5 podcasts. So you kept me busy.
5?
5 podcasts.
5? Well, no, yeah, if it was the Atsushi Torita show, it would have only been about 3.
Well, I tell you this, you're keeping me so busy that my pillow, which loves my head, has a bone to pick with you. But
okay, I'll stay away from your pillow. I'll keep that in mind.
Getting back to the interview, one of my first stories that I wrote back in 1984 when I was getting started as a reporter was about this female who was getting into sports medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, unfortunately, this talk was pretty long and we had to cut some of it out, but some of the things that he was talking about that didn't make the show kind of conjured up some of the memories about that for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I obviously would like to go chronologically and address in the interview, but the thing that really jumped out about this or from this interview was the statement he made about Yuya Hasegawa and him saying, yeah, that even if the ankle was broken, he would try to go out and play. And
mm-hmm.
of course, he later contradicted that because he said it was maybe a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
that the Japanese players are like that, and that most of the guys would do that. But then he gave that instance of the kid Danny Espinosa and said that this guy had a bad quad or a hammy, and mm-hmm. he was trying to hide it, and he was trying to play. And so, you know, I understand this now. You know, it made me think of all these guys. You know, that when I was playing basketball, and I always bring up my basketball day references, you know.
Yeah, John does, absolutely.
We didn't have a trainer, of course. And mm-hmm. and so, you know, whatever you had, you either ignored it or you taped it up and you just went out and played. And I think that's
back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day. Well, you know, if there had been a trainer, we probably could have gotten some treatment, or they would have said, you know, you're probably better off not doing this or that, or when you do these movements, this is going to tax that area, and probably that's what's going to give you some trouble. So if you try to stay away from these particular movements and everything, that might help. But, you know, we didn't have any of that, so... Yeah, I think it's a player-to-player thing. Some guys will say, you know, I'm injured, I really can't go, even though they want to go. And I think it's a thing about fringe players, especially with Hasegawa. He's the kind of guy, he doesn't carry the team. He hasn't had that spot where he's locked in as written in every day to play. And so I think he doesn't want to miss any ABs. He doesn't want to be a guy who gets replaced. If it's a different guy, if it's a guy like a full-time player, he would say...
Well, I'm no full-time player. He's coming off a season in which he won a Pacific League Best Nine Award.
No, I'm not talking about every year. I don't know
if it was last year.
It was last year, okay. But still, I mean...
He's still established, but...
He's established, but he doesn't carry the team. I think guys who carry the team, I think, you know, they know they can miss a few days and get their mm-hmm. spot back. But you sit out the lineup a couple days and somebody else is playing, well, you might not get back in for it.
With the Hawks especially, because they're very deep.
Exactly.
They've got guys who are sitting around playing cards in their minor league facility who can really hit, can really play, who got nothing to do. Their baseball career is playing cards and trying to get better in the Western League.
And I think those fringe players like that, those are the guys this really affects. It's not mm-hmm. it's not about, you know, the ace of the staff or the number four hitter or the number three hitter. It's about the guys who they're not guaranteed tomorrow.
Yes and no. But I hear what you're saying about it being a cultural, about not necessarily being cultural thing. And I kind of agree with you. I think the cultural part comes in how the team deals with it as a group. Mm. I think players are players. They're essentially in the same position. They're trying to get playing time and secure playing time. And that doesn't change wherever you go. However, but I think your view of the veteran players in Japan is, I think this is where the Japanese culture is. The veteran players in Japan are more likely, I think, than other veteran, more established players otherwise, are more likely to say, oh, no, I can play.
Right.
I think that's where the cultural difference comes in, because I know I mentioned O because we had this conversation, oh, my gosh, 8 years ago. 8 years ago, in which he was referring to players, and I think the player he was referring to was Nobuhiko Matsunaka,
yeah.
And basically who was playing hurt and wasn't helping the team, but wouldn't get out of the lineup, wouldn't say he was hurt. So here's a guy who was a Triple Crown winner, but he wasn't helping the team until basically they had to, you know, chain him to the bench.
Because your seat is ready, sir.
Yes, but the team couldn't make a decision to bench him if he said he was okay because of his status. So he kept playing and costing the team because the team couldn't make up its mind how to deal with a guy who's, you know, so, you know, a Triple Crown winner.
Yeah, that's why I said, I mean, it's player to player. It's not, and it's personality to personality. Yeah.
But I do think that that's where the cultural impact comes in, with established players saying, I'm going to play, and also with the team not wanting to make a decision about it, which is something he touched on quite a bit.
Yeah. And then, you know, he talked about the systematic inadequacies of Japan, and I think this is something Bobby Valentine stressed so much when he was here in NPB, and he said, look, you need more levels. We need to layer the baseball levels here so that a guy doesn't just sit around and play minor league games, which I think you said, how many games do they have a week? Like four or five?
Usually four or five, yeah.
You know, that's not enough. They need to play more. And
they've got, you know, and we're talking, how many people are we talking about? Four or five games. So there's 28 guys on the first team, mm-hmm. and you've got a 70-man roster plus developmental guys. And the Hawks have like 20 guys. Hawks and the Giants have like 20 developmental guys. They got 90 guys, 62 guys to play four games a week.
Yeah. The simple math tells you that you're not going to, you know, you have to practice to get better. But as he said, as Torita-san said, you need games to get better. And in the States, look, they find the level where you can get out there and play games.
Mm.
And, you know, you don't sit around, you go to a different level. And they don't have that here. And, you know, indie ball has obviously added another layer, so to speak. I don't know how easy it is for one guy to move up or move from that, but
yeah,
at least it's there.
And sure, so it is there.
And so I understand that systematic, I mean, like I said, inadequacy, and I think Japan has to figure out what to do about that. Maybe play, I mean, we talked to Lasting's Millage last year when he was here.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, look, baseball is a sport that's played every day. Just play every day.
Mm-hmm.
7 days a week, play games in the minor leagues. There's no reason to sit around and just play four or five games. A team can come out and play a four-game series, and you can get in. You know, you just did the math. You can get 60 guys to play over those four games, and then wins and losses don't matter. It's minor league baseball. Just get the games in, see who's developing. Get these guys in real game situations and see how they react.
Well, I'm going to go off on. I'm going to.
Uh-oh. Hit a button.
A tangent.
Hit a button.
You did.
Can I hit rewind?
You did.
Can I erase it?
Yep. And that is wins and losses. This is the biggest problem. The biggest problem with minor league baseball in America is what you just said. Wins and losses don't matter. That's the biggest problem with minor league baseball, is that they're basically teaching guys that you're playing to win, but you're not. And winning, everything, and you say it over and over again,
mm-hmm.
everything in baseball is about winning.
Right.
If you're not contributing to winning, then it doesn't matter. That's not quite true. I mean, that's an overstatement because – but if you're not doing the things that contribute to wins, and minor league baseball is so often the winning can be thought of as a distraction, and I think that's absolutely the wrong way to go. But that's another story. That's another that's a whole philosophical argument, and I won't get into it too much here. But anyway, so go ahead. That was my tangent.
Okay, gosh, that was short. No, all I meant was in the overall scheme of things, yeah,
sure.
a championship on the minor league level doesn't get you anything. It just means that that you won a minor league championship. But let's see a team wins 10 straight minor league championships. Now you're saying, okay, well, you've got a really strong minor league system and the coaching
right.
system is good.
That's
and
the
all
problem.
That stuff.
But
nobody does that. And that's, you wouldn't expect any teams to do that.
Well, the reason it's a problem is because the minor leagues are operated as colonies. You know, they don't belong to the locale where they're playing. They're not, you know, the only people who care, the people who do care about whether they win or lose are the people who live there and go to the games. They care whether they win a championship or not. And the fact that it doesn't, when the front, you know, the major league team doesn't care what happens in San Jose or Fresno or Rockford, Illinois, speaks volumes about, you know, an issue with baseball. You know, this whole minor league system is an issue, but it's a philosophical issue again. But it is it's vitally important to the people who go and pay tickets to watch those games.
Yeah.
And to the guys who are on the team, but to the major league team, it's like, cut the whining about winning games and play third base where you can't, you know?
Right.
So anyway, moving along.
Well, I mean, you know, I understand your argument and I don't know that. I mean, I think it's important to instill a winning attitude and all that stuff. But a lot of times little Johnny gets sent down a level and with a note from the teacher that says Johnny's got to shorten his swing with two strikes, or in this case, Taro's having trouble with the curve.
Right.
And so they get him out there to work on those things. It's not about actually winning games. It's about working on.
Well, it's about building skills that allow you to win games.
Exactly.
And well, I'm all for that. I mean, that happens at the major league. That happens at every level.
Yeah.
You have to make adjustments you have to make adjustments so you can transfer what you can do into winning games. Right. So, no, I'm all behind that. I'm just sort of attacking that sort of laissez-faire, let's not care about, you know, minor league baseball thing that has become the norm in America. So I'm pretty much attacking that whole thought process as being ridiculous.
Right. Well, I would like them to, I'd like to see the layers of minor league baseball improve here in Japan. And
yeah, and I'd like to see it improve in America too. I'd like them to blow up the farm system.
Oh, wow. Well,
yeah, make everybody independent.
Yeah. That would make people want to win.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, yeah, sure. Blow up the major leagues as well. I'm okay with that. It doesn't, you know, rip them to shreds. Do what they, you know, they did with the AT&T. But I'm a bit of an anarchist in that respect. But let's stick to the point. But yeah. But you know, the interesting thing for me is that it was about the best explanation. Now, as I said, I asked O this question about on a number of times, and people keep giving me the same answer. We don't have a deep minor league system, so players have to practice extensively before the major league games, or they're not going to get better. Well, yes, but this is about the best explanation I've heard about that. I'm saying, well, you do have a minor league system. Why don't you let the guys practice in the minor leagues and then, you know, and bring them up if they succeed? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, of course, as you said, there's an overloading in the minor league system. There's so many players. There's not enough games with so many players. And the other thing is that there's always the thinking that this guy might be needed to play tomorrow. You know, that Torita-san talked about. This guy, you know, he's out of high school, but, you know, who knows, somebody might get injured, and before we can get a foreign player to come up and take his place, because those are the guys you can easily sign during the season, this guy might be needed to play first base for us. So that was about the best explanation I've heard of that. I mean, normally it's just, well, we're not deep, so we have to practice. We're using high school kids, so we have to practice. And I don't really buy any of that. But the idea is that we're using them, and some of these guys might have to actually play. But there's also the other thing about Japan. You know, when these kids come up in Japanese baseball, you know, or any Japanese sports in school, they practice all year round, and they have the ratio of practice to game time is incredible. Yeah. I mean, in American high school baseball, you might play a few games a week. But in Japan, you'll like play on the weekends. And you'll have 100 people in the baseball club squeezed into two games or three games.
Yeah.
You know, most of those guys are going to basically practice and never even get into a game. And you don't have on the baseball team in Japanese high schools, you don't have different teams. You don't have different levels like you would in America.
Like a varsity and a junior varsity.
No, you've got one team.
Right.
You got one team. You got 12 guys who are going to play and 80 guys who aren't.
They don't even layer it in high school.
Well, they do to some, you know, they'll have inter-squad games and they'll have like little friendlies and other things. But the basic thing is the best players play, everybody else practices. And that's the way it is in you know, that is a cultural thing. So to me, that was kind of interesting, his explanation for that. Now, the Hawks, of course, have a third team. Now, they don't have a league for third teams in the Western League, but the Western League is catching up in terms of the number of games they play. The Eastern League has been kind of the pioneer, but a lot of that, a pioneer in the sense of expanding the schedule, creative scheduling to get more and more games, playing against corporate league teams, playing against university
teams, yeah, I've
seen that. Independent minor league teams, you know, whoever they can play, they're going to play, you know, regardless of the competition, they're going to play. The Western League team, it's first of all, their schedule is harder because the Western League is scattered between Fukuoka and Osaka. Osaka.
Right.
The Eastern League is all around Tokyo, with the exception of Rokten, which is in Yamagata, I believe now, on the Sea of Japan coast. So that makes it hard. But there are ways of working around that they're trying to do. The union's concerned about this, I've been told. But anyway, so that's interesting. The other thing that caught my attention was something. It brought me straight back to Trey Hillman's favorite topic 10 years ago, which was accountability. And what Torita-san was talking about is, you know, he said, who makes the line?
Yeah, who draws that line?
Yeah, who said this guy can't play? Well, of course, the manager is the guy.
Well, I mean,
and it's the manager making the decision. But if he doesn't know, you can't expect him to make the decision.
Right, he has to have the information. So it's that relationship, and he did talk about that. First of all, the players are going to lie.
Right.
So the trainer has to make a decision based on, and you know, you say, hey, look, if this guy can run, you take a look at him running the bases.
Right.
You know, you put him through the test, you put him through the motions, and then you give the information. So I see that he's in a difficult position because, you know, like I said, had we had a trainer, I would have stayed away from him. You know, if I would have just never gone to the training room. I would have never limped. I would have never shook a hand. You know, if I got up with an injury, I'd just walk back down the court or whatever it is that I had to do to hide it. So I just would never have a relationship with the trainer. I don't know you. I don't know your name. I don't want to know what you look like. Don't look at me.
So
I mean, you know,
you're just guys, being mean, John. You just don't like the trainers.
No, that's, you know, conditioning coach, trainers, all those guys, just you know, tell me what I need to do, and then I'll do it, and then leave me alone, because I'm playing. So, yeah, if you're not going to get the right information from him, then it's up to you as a trainer to decipher. Now, so you're automatically part of, like, the management side. You're not among the players. Mm. So it's a really difficult relationship.
It is.
And it's an interesting dynamic that he explained. So he said somebody has to draw a line, and it's essentially he's the guy. Because he's not going to get the right information, or the true or the pure information from the player, but he's got to inform the manager, because right. If you use this player, he's either not going to get better or not going to be contributing.
Well, what he was the thing that struck me is this idea that in a and part of this, and here's the cultural aspect, wishful denial.
Meaning?
In Japan. Well, if we don't notice it, maybe it won't exist. You know, if the guy doesn't say he's hurt, then maybe he's okay to play.
Mm.
And nobody wants to take responsibility for getting him out of the game, so let's just let him play. And this happens a lot in Japanese organizations, this idea that if we just let the guy say he's good enough, it's a matter of company loyalty trumps accountability.
We see
this in many dynamics. I think it happens everywhere to some degree, but in Japan it's really big, where if you're loyal to the company and you're gung-ho, you get away with stuff, you get away with doing stupid, unproductive or counterproductive things because you're a company man. And in Japan, people will turn their backs on behave, because loyalty to your group is more important than loyalty to anybody else, or to doing right and well. Right and wrong is about loyalty to your group more than it is about some sort of abstract social construct of right and wrong. So if it's being loyal to your players, you don't trade them, you play them when they're no good, you keep them on the roster when they're no good, mm-hmm. you give them jobs as coaches when they're no good. And on the other hand, the players have a responsibility. Everybody has a responsibility to the group, and this sort of group think sometimes really takes hold. And you see, and I'm thinking of a couple of teams in particular, but it's pretty common. And when Trey Hillman came in, he said, and Marty Brown to the same thing, and Bobby and Terry Collins the same thing. Look, we need to have responsibility here. We need somebody, you know. The pitching coach is saying, give him the Marty Brown example. The pitching coach is standing there watching a middle reliever with a bulky arm Doesn't mean he throws balks a lot. He balks a lot, but troublesome arm. Guy coming off injury, throwing 140 pitches in the bullpen and talking about how good he felt.
Right, yeah, no.
And Marty saying, you know, we have no system for who's responsible for that kind of behavior. Is it the pitcher? Is it the coach who's standing? And the answer is nobody. So what Torita-san's saying is we need a – well, we have a chain of command. We have everybody, and then there's the manager who makes the decision. And then – but he said, okay, so let's keep him informed. And what Kudo – the Kudo innovation here is that the coaches are going to be part of the process, which they didn't used to be. The pitching coach always, because he's got to be dealing with pitchers' injuries.
Right. That makes sense.
And but generally the other coaches are sort of there, and the batting coaches to some degree if they don't like the swing. But here's the trainer, the training staff talking to the coaches. Watch for this. Watch for this. This is what I see. Tell me what you see.
Right.
And if guys have different impressions, they need to share them and correct them so they get the best information. It's not, well, I saw this and ignoring what the trainer saw, or the trainer saw this and ignoring what the batting coach saw. No, I saw his swing was good. I didn't have a problem. The other thing we spoke about before the podcast was this idea that he had a lot of trouble implementing in Japan, is this idea that you can play, a guy could play because he's good enough to play, but he's not enough to go through the rigorous practice, pregame practice.
Right, the comment you made, you can play him, you can practice him and not play him, but you can't play him and
play
not
him
practice.
And not practice him. That's not quite true. It's not set in stone.
Yeah.
But it's generally true. People think that if you can't practice, you can't play. But very often guys will practice and practice and practice when they're hurt.
Mm.
And they're sort of waiting for them to run the practice gauntlet, to borrow that expression again, and come out unscathed so they know they're ready. You know, it's basically, okay, walk across the fire pit and your feet are okay, then we'll put you in the game.
Well, I mean, I talked to – this was a long time ago, but I talked to Alonzo Powell a long time ago, and he told me this story about a guy who wasn't fit to play on the first team.
Right.
And they sent him down to the minors, and as you probably recall, back in the 90s, they used to play both the early 90s. They used to play the minor league team, the farm team, in the daytime at Nagoya Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the evening, that's when the Dragons would play their regular home games. And so Alonzo went to the stadium early, and he saw the guy who was supposedly hurt, you know, working his hiney off. And he's like, well, I thought he was supposed to be hurt. He's down here working harder than he would be if he was on the first team. So,
sure.
And that's what happened. So, like I said, systematic inadequacies.
Yeah, very much. I think in both physically systematic and also systems of communication and accountability, which is the other thing Trey Hillman harped on, was communication. So you get those two are vital, and he's really trying to get them in. And he's got a manager now who's receptive to that. Now, I don't want to go into too much detail, but there's a story I heard last year about one manager in Japan in a meeting, when basically the meeting ended, he said, is there anything else? And a bullpen coach said, yeah, I think the relievers are looking ragged. Maybe we should give them a day off tomorrow on the travel day from practice. And it was towards the end of the season. And a few weeks later, the new assignments came out for the following season, and this guy had been demoted to the farm team bullpen coach.
Yeah.
So basically, this manager didn't like – he wanted communication, but he wanted communication in a certain way, you know, in certain channels. You know, you tell me first before you tell everybody else, kind of thing. And I don't think it was that's a reflection on the manager himself. But I think it was a reflection on the fact that he was not easy to approach, and he didn't want to hear that in front of the group. And apparently the response was, well, I'm – anything you want to talk about, and the end result was, I'm the manager. That's my decision, not yours.
Yeah.
Get your butt out of here.
Yeah. See you later, punk.
He would have been open to communication, but he needed it in a particular way, and I think Kudo's saying, no, just give it to me.
All right. Well, this was a really insightful interview, and I thank you for doing it, and probably we will hear back from Mr. Torita in the future.
Believe so.
And I'll say hello to him when I'm out at the park. Now, a person who I think he knows I'm not sure how well he knows him, but Motozumi Kitsunai, who's an expert in kinesiology, which is the study of movements. And this guy went over to the Yakult Swallows, and I translated a story this past week about Mr. Kitsunai. So, he said he wants to help the Swallows, and we know they've just been. I've been making jokes about how the.
We all joke. If you can't make a joke about Swallows' injuries, you need to give up your reporter's card.
Yeah, about the injury bug, and I at first I think maybe the first year of the injuries I said it was snacking on them. Now it's just feeding off of them, and they've just been devastated. And if they could stay healthy, especially, I can't even pick out. At first it seemed like it was a lot of position players, and then it seemed like it was a lot of pitchers, but it's just everybody. And so they brought this guy, Kitsunai,
yeah,
over.
Yeah, ask yourself a question. Over the last 3 years, what Swallows regulars haven't been hurt?
Yeah,
Cow has been, the pitcher, the lefty's been pretty healthy. Of course, he isn't that good when he is healthy, so that's not a big plus. Anybody else?
I don't know. So they brought him over, and I think he had... I don't know how much he can change things, but he's bringing over this philosophy that he's going to help the players react to the unexpected things that happen on the field a little bit better, because those sometimes are the muscles that haven't been warmed up or haven't been loosened up that you use when, let's say, you're trying to get out of the way of a runner, or, you know, there's some herky-jerky sudden movement that you do, maybe a bad hop, something. And so he wants to get all those muscles warmed up. And I remember talking to Hiroshi Gondo about 2 or 3 years ago, and he said something's really wrong over there. Something's weird in Swallowland, and he doesn't know why they had such bad luck with the injuries. But they've gone through now some trainers and some conditioning coaches. I think the past 2 or 3 years, I think they keep getting new ones or firing people, and they keep making changes, and they haven't had any luck. So. Hopefully they'll have better luck with this new approach.
Well, actually, you know, the Swallows got a new, they made some changes in the offseason, not only to the coaching staff, but to Jingu Stadium. They're being developed. And I believe they put out bids for ambulance service, and they're really expecting to make some good income, money from companies that want to provide them with ambulance and health services.
Boom!
They're turning into a revenue stream.
Oh, gosh. Boom! We're going to have to get
exclusive rights to Swallows, to helping Swallows injured players. Who wants to bid?
Gosh, we're going to have to get a hashtag and a sound to go along with your thumps.
Save that for the Swallows.
Wow. All right. So let's make.
Yeah. Well, Kenjiro Nomura is not around to kick around anymore, so I got to pick a new.
Oh, wow. Yeah. All right. Let's make a two-seam transition and talk about Hiroki Kuroda.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
He finally arrived in Japan. Now, remember, we knew he signed with the Carp, and we saw his presser from, I think he was working out in L.A.
Yeah, he lives in L.A., actually.
And so he finally landed on Japanese soil, and, he got the rock star treatment because he made an entrance to arriving into...
Hiroshima.
Oh, he landed.
Well, I mean,
I know that there were fans, some 100 fans, they said, met him at the airport. And I'm like, sure. That's nothing to be talking about, 100 fans.
Yeah, but Hiroshima Airport is not like near Hiroshima. It's like closer to Nagoya.
it's like the size of a living room, I suppose, to pile on.
It's not big, but it's like an hour from Hiroshima.
So he had this dramatic entrance, and Matsuzaka wasn't getting the focus, and so it was nice. So I saw highlights from his press conference, much of the text I read online, and I saw some of it on TV.
Your translations got very wide play.
Mine?
Yep. But you put them in your blog, did you not?
Oh, yeah, I blog.
I saw them everywhere. I'm going, these are John's translations.
Oh, everywhere, huh?
Over the place. All the news sources in the U.S. were using yours, unaccredited, most of them.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Well, look at that. All right, well.
He's fine.
Well, he said that, the mental and physical tolls were tough, and he battled every season, and I just assumed he was enjoying his time in the majors,
Well,
he was 32 when he went over there, so I don't know what he expected. yeah, it's not going to be easy. You're competing against 20-something-year-old sure. guys. And you got to keep your job. You got to keep your spot in the rotation. Got to stay healthy. It's tough.
It is hard.
It's not easy.
Well, exactly. And he also said in the interview that he probably put, you know, sort of a little bit in hindsight, he put too much extra pressure on himself because he said, when I left the carp, I don't want to come back a failure.
Mm.
And because he said he put yoke na kateni, jibun ni pressure o kakita, I put a lot of pressure on myself.
A lot of added pressure
that was unnecessary. And then, of course, pitching for the Yankees, you know, nobody needs that. There's plenty to go around, which he mentioned also. But he felt under the gun, you know, he's such a serious guy. Somebody said on my Twitter feed, he never looked like he enjoyed his pitching, but he didn't enjoy his pitching when he was in Japan. He's so serious on the mound. He is businesslike.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote that. I said I don't remember ever really seeing him smile out there and having a good time, even when he was with Hiroshima. And he wasn't having a good time out there because he was losing so much.
He's like a brain surgeon. I mean, in the sense, these games are really serious. What he does is so serious to him. And that's the way he treats it. And that explains a lot of things about his success. There's one of the people who's works for the Yankees was commenting that he's going to carve up NPB hitters. And I said, well, why would that be new? That's what he did. That's what he did 8 years ago. The fact that it was hard to notice because he was playing for the worst offensive team in the Central League.
And they didn't win a lot of games.
And they didn't score any runs behind him. And, you know, he was really, and I believe this seriously, he and Daisuke Miura in this from 2002 to 2007 were easily the top two pitchers in the Central League. Mm-hmm. I don't think any mistake about that. They're so far ahead of the curve, but they played for the league's two worst teams. Mm-hmm. So nobody thought of them as being the best, although Kuroda did win a best nine as a pitcher.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him pitch, and I'm expecting good things. But I do want to see him smile out there on the mound sometimes. And
when he wins, he smiles. You know, when he gets out of jams, he smiles. But he's not too demonstrative. You know, he's ball player's ball player. You know, he's going to be fun to watch. He's fun to watch him pitch. I mean, what he does on the mound, he's not joyful, but you know what he does to the ball is pretty special.
Yep.
So,
all right.
Okay. And now the news yesterday was that Kuroda's ditching his major league preparations for Japanese style preparations.
Meaning he's
go throwing longer bullpens.
Okay. He's going to throw longer bullpen sessions.
and the reporters were struggling, you know, were looking for answers. You know, his first bullpen was 36 pitches when he came from the U.S., and then yesterday was 73 pitches. So double, and they're thinking, wow, he only threw 30, 40 pitches in the majors, and now he's throwing 73. What's next, 150? And he said, essentially, I think he's going to find a happy medium. But the point being that not that now he can go back to Nagekomi, you know, throwing your arm into shape, mm-hmm. you know, throwing as much as you need to find your groove. No matter how many hundreds of pitches it takes. I don't think he's going there, but he did say in September that I asked him the question. I said, so the team, how did you deal with the team prohibiting you from throwing long bullpens? He said it wasn't a matter of what the team wanted. So I don't know whether it was team policy or not, but his plan was to go with what everybody else is doing because they're used to dealing with this system, with this season, with this lack of travel days. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to learn about, you know, he was going all in to do major league style. He said, if I don't go all the way, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yesterday there was some speculation that now that the team's allowing him to throw longer bullpens, this is what's going to happen. But he said, no, basically I'm going to be expected to go deeper into the games here. And I'm going to have more rest, so I want to basically throw 100-pitch bullpens before camp's over. But, I mean, he used to throw every year. He used to throw, like, one 250, 300-pitch bullpen when he was with the Carp.
Yeah, well, he wasn't 40.
True. So anyway, so that was kind of the news yesterday, but I don't think we're going to see the I don't think we're going to see 150 pitches even at him. But he said, if I'm going to pitch 8 or 9 innings, if you consider that pitch, those pitches and what the work you do in the bullpen to warm up before the game, you're probably going to throw 150 or 160 pitches in a day. So I want to get up to about 100 in camp.
Okay, sounds good. Now we can make a four-seam transition into Julio Franco, who's back. He was coming back to Japan, and he's a 56-year-old guy who is going to be the player manager for the independent Ishikawa Stars. Is that the name of it?
Million Stars.
The Ishikawa Million Stars.
In the Shinetsu Baseball Challenge League, which is expanding this year.
Huh.
To Fukushima Prefecture.
Yeah, well,
Akinori Iwamura will be the player manager.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I don't know that they were teammates though. They
were not.
They were not teammates.
They were. Their careers barely overlapped. Iwamura was a farmhand on the Swallows the last year Franco was here in 1998 as the captain of the Chibolote Marines.
That would be a good game to go to when those guys hook up for the first time. That would be interesting.
Well, I'm eager because
I want to go too.
Well, the thing is that the BC League is split into two divisions, and the Western League, the Hokuriku teams along the Sea of Japan coast, don't come this way that often. Tsukuma and Guma and Nagano and Fukushima and so on. So they might just be up here once, but I certainly when they come here, I wanna be on that.
Me too. So I read a story that you know how I like the fancy leads, and this writer wrote Julio Franco is making 41-year-old Ichiro Suzuki look wet behind the ears, which I thought was pretty clever. And
he used to have big ears, so that probably would have been more appropriate.
Yeah, but here's the thing: I'm not sure how I feel about this. And plus, because of the fact that we just talked about that baseball in Japan needs these layers for these players to develop, and you got a 56-year-old guy who's going to take at bats away from other guys who probably could. I don't know that they're going to develop like we talked about earlier. It's not like guys are making jumps from indie ball to the developmental squad, and then from there to the minor league squad or the Nigun team, and then from there to the top team. I haven't heard a lot about it, but
we do.
We do hear about it on occasion, but so I don't know. I don't know how to feel about this because he'll obviously be taking my bats away from some of these players who are trying to develop. So,
well, the independent leagues are interesting because they're a free source of available talent during the season. You know,
you can have a tryout and then sign one of these.
Yeah, you could sign a guy off the independent league if the team and the league are willing to sell him.
Right.
They'll take an offer for him. They'll negotiate terms of a contract. So you can buy these guys. So, and that happens. It's happened mostly with foreign players. Alessandro Maestri was one. And the guy who just re-signed with Oryx. Francisco Colabayo. Caraballo. Let's get his name right. Anyway, so they just re-signed a guy that they plucked in the middle of the season. He was the first foreign player to be signed from an independent minor league team.
Well, I'm just wondering, and I'll be interested to, I'm sure the Japanese papers will jump all over him when he actually gets here, and so we'll probably find out sooner than later. But my first question is, what's the goal here? Is he mulling the idea of continuing his career as a player a little bit? Does he just want to dabble and play at his age, or does he want to focus on the transition into the field manager spot? And, you know, obviously he'll be able to sell some tickets. This could be a shining example of what hard work can do. And all these guys who are 35 and still playing can still say, hey, look, I still have a chance. You know, I don't have to give up. I can work hard. I can work hard now. I can use the tools that I have and develop my game on the mental side and get smarter. If I can't, whatever I'm losing physically, I can make up on the mental side and maybe still have a chance. So I don't know. I think it'd be interesting to talk to him. I'm looking forward to getting
him. He's a great guy. He loves Japan. He loved playing here. The fact that he had to go back and leave he probably would have stayed here forever if he had the option, but it was a case of his family not wanting to be in Japan.
Okay.
So one day I sat with his wife at Cebu Dome while we were watching a Marines Lions game. I got, what do I want to be in Japan for? There's no shopping. There's no places to go. There's nothing to do. And I'm thinking, we're out of here. She's going, oh, we're out of here. As soon as the season's over, I'm not coming back.
Yeah. Sometimes these decisions that are made on these guys' careers are not always made based on their talents or their desires.
Yeah, I mean, very often it's to be frank, it's where did your family feel comfortable with you being? I mean, that's after all, those are the important things.
That's right. All right, quickly, we want to talk about Samurai Japan. Now, both rosters have been set for the two-game set that's going to be played on March 10th and 11th at Tokyo Dome. The Samurai Japan team versus the European All-Stars. I'm not sure what the name of that team is going to be. Is it the Euro-Stars? All European Stars. Okay, and that's should be an interesting game.
Most of those players are actually from Europe.
Yeah, and I know Andre Jones, Alessandro Maestri, Rick Vanderhurk, those guys who are playing in Japan. Andrew played in Japan last year. He's not going to be playing in Japan this year, but Maestri.
Not yet.
Yeah, Maestri and Vanderhurk are here in Japan. So I like the roster additions that Hiroki Kokubo, the Samurai Japan manager, made, bringing in some guys who hadn't played before, leaving some of the other guys off. And he said, look, I like this comment. He said, look, I know what some of these other guys can do, the Shohei Ohtanis, whom he left off the roster. I want to look at the guys who, again, he didn't say fringe. He didn't use the word fringe, but I want to look at the guys whose abilities I'm not sure of. I want to see what they can do in game situations.
Give other
guys an opportunity.
Well, the other noticeable thing, and I think this was fairly... Jason Koskrey of the Japan Times and I were tweeting about this, as you probably saw. Basically, he left off everybody who might start the first two who might be the starting pitcher of the first two games of this season. You know, and then we're talking about the second game on the 11th is going to be 16 days before opening day. And Kokubo is showing, we are going to call him Twinkle Toes. Because he's
Hiroki Twinkle Toes Kokubo.
He's tiptoeing around these teams like he's gonna break eggs, like he's walking on eggs or something. You know, like I can't upset their preparations. It's so Japanese. It's so ridiculous. It's 2 weeks. They can figure it out. Let the guy throw five or six innings. They're going to be coming from preseason games where they're throwing five and six innings by that stage.
Have to throw five or six. Throw three.
Yeah, but let him, and say, look, I want to, you go to the team and say, look, I want Shohei Ohtani to pitch five innings, and maybe he'll pick up something, or maybe it'll be, he'll see different style of play, he'll see different swings, he may have to make an adjustment. Well, he probably won't, to just, turn on the gas and burn him. do what he did to the Koreans. I think it was Samsung Lions the other day when, 150-kilometer fastball followed by that massive 12-6 curveball. They should have called the police and had him arrested. That was illegal. You can't do that.
At the very least, it's just mean.
It was nasty stuff. You shouldn't be. That shouldn't be allowed. Yeah. So anyway, go with it's a national team, go with the best guys, but Maeda's not going to. Kaneko, I understand because he was hurt, but he didn't take anybody. And then he goes, Fujinami is on the team, and Kazuhisa Makito is on the team, who was used in relief in November. Mm-hmm. Fujinami said, Kokubo told him he's going to get one or at the maximum of two innings on the 11th. And he's going like, what? In relief, two innings? Are you kidding me? And he's going, throw me more. And it's like going, well, I have to be careful because of your team. I might disrupt your two innings 2 weeks before the start of the season. I mean, these guys are throwing 150-pitch bullpens. What difference does two innings make?
It doesn't make sense. But hey, what can we do? It's Japan, man.
It is indeed.
They have a routine. They can't upset the routine. They can't disrupt the routine.
That's the point. The decision has been made not to make a decision, and we'll just avoid it by having everybody throw one inning.
All right. One other note. Hitoki Iwase, the all-time saves leader in Japan, the Chunichi Dragons closer, is having some trouble, an injury situation. He wasn't able to complete a bullpen the other day.
I don't know it's an injury because he's not talking.
Uh-huh.
He said well,
we just assume this is an injury.
Yeah. And he was hurt all last year. He pitched. He barely pitched. He got double he did reach 20 saves in 34 games, but
somehow
he pitched poorly. He often pitched poorly. He wasn't able to stay with the team the whole season because of an elbow injury or a shoulder injury, I don't recall which. And he's, you know, was it the same? No. And that was the end of the conversation, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always look at the closers in Japan in particular. It just seems like they don't kick around at the end of their careers like hitters do, and they become pinch hitters. You know, the hitters become pinch hitters, and they're stars, and they get the Maeda, Tomonori Maeda treatment, and they're lauded and applauded every time they come to hit, and then they just kind of get a hit and then retire, and blah, blah, blah. The closers just kind of fade away. They fade to dark. Some of them, you know, go to the maybe the setup role instead of the closer role. And they just kind of like one day they wake up ineffective, and the next thing you know, they're put out to pasture. So,
well, speaking of guys who are not put out to pasture, I saw that Shinichi Koyama is still pitching with Rakuten. Who does he have pictures of doing what with him?
he's probably still throws hard. But anyway, I think the Dragons can still be in good shape with Koji Fukutani and then Katsuki Matayoshi, the two rookies last year who are coming into their second year. Matayoshi was picked for the national team. I think if Shinji Tajima picks up where he left off in his rookie season, this will be his third year. I think they'll be all right. So I'm pretty sure they're going to be okay. They survived. They're not going to be that good anyways. I don't know how many save situations they're going to have to worry about blowing. Anyway, we got to run. It's been a really long show. We thank you for listening to the end. No questions this week, but if you have any, send them to yakyujohn@gmail.com or leave us a note on the very active Facebook page, and we will see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks a lot.
Okay, take care.
Enjoy your off season. One World Sports is the exclusive home of the Yomiuri Giants in North America and features live coverage of all Giants home games. Please contact your local cable provider to find out how you can watch One World Sports.